In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking with a former member of the U.S. intelligence community who says that the United States is losing the war on terror. Our guest for the program is Michael Scheuer. He spent more than 20 years working for the CIA, and during the time that he was still there, near the end of his time at the CIA, he published anonymously a book titled Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. It's published by Brassey's and is certainly out there on the bookstore, still with the, at least the copy I have, without his name on it. He has since resigned from the CIA, but he continues to make the argument that the greatest danger for Americans confronting the radical Islamist threat is the belief that Muslims attack us for what we are and for what we think rather than for what we do. He's joining us this morning by telephone. We'll talk about some of the ideas in the book, also get some of his reaction to what has been happening in Washington under the umbrella of restructuring of intelligence gathering, some of the recent changes that have happened at the CIA. And of course, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief. We ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. But of course, questions, comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. And if it would be a long-distance call for you, use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, locally, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Scheuer, hello.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time.
My pleasure, sir.
I have I've been collecting articles about you for a while now in anticipation of talking, and there was a piece that appeared actually in December last year. This happened to be in the LA Times. There probably was some other places as well, where you the headline that they put on this piece was "Why I Resigned from the CIA." Why did you resign from the CIA?
Several reasons, sir. The first was because I thought Americans were not being leveled with by their leaders, neither Republican nor Democrat, about the danger we faced from the Islamist movement around the world. Our leaders focusing on the idea that we're being attacked because Muslims hate the way we live, because they hate our elections and our freedoms and our a way of life generally, and I thought that, from what I knew after 20 years, was wrong. And indeed, what was motivating the violence was our policies toward the Islamic world. The second reason I resigned was because, frankly, the two commissions that investigated the 9/11 attack really were astounding in the sense that they couldn't find anyone responsible for anything. And I thought, before we reorganized the intelligence community, an assessment of personal failure or personal dereliction should have been done. And basically, those were the two reasons I resigned.
What do you think about the... well, let's first just talk about the changes that have happened in CIA. We have a new director, and a number of individuals that were in top positions have left now. So we have a number of new people in place. Do you think that that is either good for the agency or not good, or remains to be seen?
Well, I think it was good for Mr. Tenet and several of his senior lieutenants to have left. I tend to believe that they were very risk-averse in terms of taking chances overseas to protect Americans. They, like much of our senior bureaucracy, is more worried about America's reputation and European opinion and amorphous things like that rather than protecting Americans. I thought we should give Mr. Goss, the new director of Central Intelligence, an opportunity to set his own ship right. But unfortunately, and I have to say that I'm at a distance now, several of the senior people that left were people you would have not wanted to leave. The deputy director of operations, for example, Mr. Kappas, was really one of the better officers in our service and probably the best deputy director of operations we would have had in a decade. And in addition, there seems to be, whether a misunderstanding or not, a mood within the agency that a certain political orthodoxy is required by the analysts, in the sense of not objecting too strenuously or criticizing too strenuously, rather, the impact of policy on U.S. Interests abroad.
Let me ask you to react to one other thing that has been in the news a good deal lately, and that is the reports now that, at least for the past couple of years, the Department of Defense has been operating its own covert operations department, and that a lot of the reporting that's been done on this lately suggests that this is yet another kind of weakening of the CIA, that the CIA is being pushed aside, that the Secretary of Defense has, in a sense, put together his own agency, and also there, some people are concerned that there isn't the kind of oversight of the activities of this branch of the Pentagon that there would be over the CIA. You may have some thought about that, but I guess what you think, I'm interested in what you think about the more general point about is the influence of the CIA declining? Do you think it will decline further?
I think our influence has declined, not always deservedly so. Clearly, there's been things we've been wrong about and mistakes the agency has made, but there is, within the U.S. intelligence community, at least some members of it, a desire to do things that they're not built to do. The Defense Department, for example, is not constructed to collect human intelligence. And the FBI, especially under Judge Free, but also under Mr. Mueller, seemed much more interested in deploying their officers overseas to collect intelligence rather than leaving them at home to do their job domestically. And I tend to think that the CIA has 50 years of experience in collecting human intelligence. Again, we've made mistakes, but the problem we're going to run into is services bumping into each other overseas. The Defense Department doing its own business and the FBI doing its own business. One thing that certainly eroded under Mr. Tenet was the notion that the Director of Central Intelligence was the commander of all overseas human collection operations. He certainly let other departments within the government kind of create their own services.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone listening this morning in Indiana on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello?
Hello. Three questions. The first one's just the thing you just mentioned, that you think Tenet allowed, separation of his powers, in a sense. Why do you think he did that? Is it a philosophical position, or is it a reality check with the Bush administration? And number two, the last week or 10 days, a number of pundits have talked about the relationship between our own American Revolution and what could possibly happen in Iraq now that the election is over, in the sense that we may be there for an awfully long time. As we proved to the British, you can have troops here, but you're not going to command the countryside. And I guess the third question is, what do you think the Islamists are going to do now in Iraq? I just wonder, there all of a sudden there was a certain shortage of attacks and stuff, and I just got the idea that they're, formulating something to do something drastic. And I started thinking, hell, they could start killing the people who won the election. And I just wonder, those three questions, if you could talk to them. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call.
On the first question, I think Mr. Tenet did let his control over the intelligence community erode. If you'll remember, when he appeared before the 9/11 Commission, all of the commissioners congratulated him on being so well-liked among all the departments of the intelligence community. And what that said to me was that Mr. Tenet was not very well-respected, because you cannot be DCI and be liked by everyone. You have to be able to knock heads together. And certainly in my experience, and I had some direct experience, at least on the issue of Osama bin Laden, Mr. Tenet was never willing to knock heads together to get things done. On the relationship between Iraq and the American Revolution, I wrote a book earlier in 2002 called Through Our Enemy's Eyes. And I compared at least tried to make an analogy between what Osama bin Laden and his followers were up to and what our founding fathers were up to. And one point I would make is that the Islamists, across the board in the Islamic world, tried peaceful remonstrance first. They appealed to their governments, including bin Laden. They appealed to the King of Saudi Arabia or the President of Egypt. And it was only after those remonstrances were ignored or the people who wrote them were arrested did they turn to violence. So there is a certain pattern that is reminiscent of our revolution. It's not to suggest a moral equivalency, but the pattern is very similar. And I think what's going to happen in Iraq, basically, is the Mujahideen, the insurgents, are extraordinarily patient and perseverant. We saw it in Afghanistan against the Soviets. They will continue to fight a low-level insurgency that will keep us tied up there and bleeding for the foreseeable future. They're not easily defeated people. And basically, from their perspective, an election doesn't really mean anything, especially if it turns out that the Shias have overwhelmingly won the election. The Shias, of course, are viewed by heretics by most of the Islamic world. So those are the kind of the way I would frame the three answers to those questions.
All right. Other people who are listening are certainly welcome to call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Our guest, Michael Scheuer, served in the CIA for 22 years. He has quite a lot of experience in national security issues related to both Afghanistan and South Asia. He is author of a book that he published when he was still in the CIA, and it was published anonymously. The title of the book, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. Brassies is the publisher. It's gotten quite a lot of attention. He resigned from the CIA last fall and continues to now, in a public way, make the same kind of criticism and use the same points. If you have questions, comments, you can call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here on a cell phone, so we will not make them wait. We'll go right there to, again, our line number four. Hello.
Hi. I had a question I wanted to talk to the point of, I heard the comment that comparing the insurgency in Iraq with the American Revolution. I'm not sure what I'm understanding by that. Is that being compared? Because I don't see that as being an equal comparison. The American Revolution was started by people in the United States rising up against the imperial forces of England. I don't see that connection necessarily. Is that what I'm understanding? Or
yes, clearly from the perspective of the Islamists, they have been under the yoke of what they would term imperial powers, primarily the United States and their support for governments such as Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Algeria, Jordan, Kuwait, basically tyrannies that have operated under the aegis of American economic and military power for years. And I'm not arguing that they're right. What I'm arguing is that until we see their perspective, I believe we're not going to realize how dangerous they are. And again, all of this evolved to violence after a rather lengthy period of peaceful remonstrance was not heeded by the Al Saud family in Saudi Arabia or President Mubarak in Egypt.
Okay. I guess that clears it up.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Well, that does indeed raise the questions about these insurgencies and whether or not, in fact, they are insurgencies in that sense, and that it is perhaps only secondarily about the United States.
Well, it was secondarily about the United States, but bin Laden, his influence on the Islamist movement has been, he came to believe and argued that because Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait were tyrannies, dictatorships, immune to international opinion and the concerns of human rights advocates, that their security services and militaries could do virtually anything and get away with it. Bin Laden argued, ineffectively to some extent so far, that we're never going to replace these tyrannies unless we replace their sponsor. And the United States is the person or the entity to which bin Laden has focused much of the Islamic world, arguing that if we can drive the Americans from the region, either by attacking them in the region or causing them so much pain at home that they withdraw from the region, that the rest of our problems, i.e. the Al-Saud family, the Mubaraks, the Israelis, will fall of their own weight, because once the American shield is removed, they'll be rather easy pickings.
The president, in the way that he has talked about the war on terror, has done a couple of things. He has cautioned the American people that it's not a conventional war, that it's something that will not be easily won, that it is something that's going to take a long time. At the same time, I think the administration would point to some successes. They would say that Afghanistan is no longer an important base of operations for al-Qaeda. While we have not captured Osama bin Laden, we have captured some of the top leaders in the organization. We perhaps know more about them than we did before. That there has been no major terrorist event since, certainly nothing of the scale of September 11th since then. And I think the administration would probably point to all of those things as successes. How do you assess those things that might be considered to be a success in the war on terror to date?
I think we certainly have scored some very, very important victories over al-Qaeda and their allied groups. But I think within the assertions of those triumphs, there is a bit of analysis by assertion. We certainly won the battle of the cities in Afghanistan, but the countryside and the Pakistani border area clearly still belong to al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and other people who are opposed to the government in Kabul. And I tend to believe that perhaps we've made too much of the election, in the sense that the returns of the election divided exactly along ethnic groups. The Pashtun tribes in the south, who have long dominated Afghanistan, have voted for Mr. Karzai, not because they're in favor of democracy, but they're in favor of their tribal domination. The other parts of the country, the minorities, voted for the Tajik, Mr. Kanuni, who is representative of the aspirations of ethnic groups that have long been at the bottom of the political totem pole, if you will. So I think Afghanistan is still a story to be told. One of the problems we have in terms of there hasn't been a terrorist event in the United States since 9/11 of comparable dimension is that two things. One is a consistent failure in the U.S. intelligence community is to believe that if someone hasn't attacked us when we expect him to attack us, it's because he's defeated or he can't attack us. Now, that may be true, but in the larger picture, the world has gone Osama bin Laden's way for the most part since 9/11. We are now involved in two protracted wars, one in Iraq, one in Afghanistan. We have military people in the Philippines, in Yemen, and other places fighting Islamic insurgents. And al-Qaeda's overall goal has been to bleed the United States economically. And I think if you focus on the budget deficit and the way it's sort of escalating, I think you'd have to say that they're having some success in those terms. The final point I would make on the top leaders in the organization, we have done a tremendous job in taking out those leaders that we were cognizant of on 9/11. And the CIA, frankly, has been at the spearhead of that effort. I would point out that one of the people we didn't know was in the leadership on 9/11 was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the person that designed and ran the operation. What we really have vis-a-vis al-Qaeda, I believe, is a body count of people. We've never had a study, either academically or within the government, of the size and structure and organizational composition of al-Qaeda. And until we have something like that to measure against, again, we have basically a body count rather than a measure of progress.
Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, someone again on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi, I have a sort of double-fold question, which I want to preface it with my understanding of the history. In 1980, Israel took out the Iraqi nuclear don't know if it was a reactor or just their plant. And I don't know if that was coordinated with the U.S. or was just a preemptive strike by the Israelis. In the Gulf War, I know that Israel was persuaded not to react to any Scud missile attacks from Iraq in order to not disturb the coalition that had been formed. Also, my understanding is that Israel was a very strong proponent of the invasion of Iraq under Bush 2, or 43 or whatever. And I'd like to know what you think about the coordination between Israeli policy and American policy. But more important than that, the Islamic perception of that. I know that bin Laden never mentioned the Palestinians until very late in the game, when he was declaring his brotherhood with them. And the last part of the question is the most important. There are rumblings going on in the media and at conferences and at pronouncements from this administration about someone taking out Iran's nuclear capabilities, and that has to be a reference to Israel again, because they're the only other people who would really be able to do that. And if that happens, how is that going to affect us in terms of our relations or any hopes of having a relationship with the Islamic community? And I'll just listen to your answer.
All right, Mr. Shoy.
Well, thank you for those questions, sir. The first point I would make is just the general point that bin Laden has focused on the Israeli-Palestinian confrontation since at least 1979. Since he became involved in Islamist politics and Islamist insurgencies and militancy, he identified our support for Israel as a major reason why Muslims should oppose the United States. And until just 9/11, he consistently referred to the Palestinian problem, particularly drawing attention to the Israeli attack on those two refugee camps in Lebanon in the 80s, Shatila and I can't remember the other one. So part of the problem Americans have and Westerners have is they don't have ready access to what bin Laden has said. And I see one of the New York publishers were going to publish a book of bin Laden's speeches and interviews, and they have been really roundly castigated. But if such a book was published, I think Americans would quickly see that Palestine and Israel have been at the forefront of his concerns since at least 1979. On the other points, and let me speak from the Islamist perspective. I've been identified as kind of a anti-Semite and by some a right-wing weasel, as they say. But the truth of the matter is, for the Islamists, Israel and the United States are interchangeable. And our policy toward Israel is one that's viewed as the tail wagging the dog, if you will, that America doesn't behave as a great power in the sense that it basically gives Israel carte blanche to do what it wants to do. And again, I'm not saying that's the reality of the situation, but it is the perception across the Islamic world, and so often perception is reality. And I think on the point of Iran's nuclear weapons or nuclear program, I think Vice President Cheney came right out and said that the Israelis may move if we don't. And I suspect that one of the factors that will come into play on America's decision about policy toward Iran will be our estimate of what the Iranians intend or what the Israelis intend to do vis-a-vis Iran. And certainly the Israelis do things that we are surprised by. So it is a big pressure point on the United States. It's a point which our alliance with the Israelis certainly leads to dead Americans in the Islamic world. And it's an alliance we need to preserve. America has a terrible record of dropping alliances with countries, but it's certainly an alliance that needs to be restructured to reflect the fact that America is the great power and Israel is the minor power.
Let me just ask you, and we'll get some other callers here, to talk for just a moment further about Iran, because as the caller points out, there has been some reporting, and I guess the piece that stands out in my mind is the recent article that was written for the New Yorker magazine by Seymour Hersh, saying that going back to last summer that the Pentagon had been involved in covertly scouting potential attack points in Iran, and that within the administration within the Pentagon, there apparently is this idea that the United States, presumably, could carry out a series of surgical strikes, possibly simply with dropping bombs on them or possibly sending in troops and taking out a number of sites that have to do with Iran's military defense structure, particularly with its nuclear infrastructure. And that then the idea is that then the people of Iran would see the weakness of its religious leadership, and that then there would be some kind of popular uprising, that the people would rise up and sweep aside the theocracy, and then we would have a democratic, Western-oriented new government in Iran. That's the line of thinking that they seem to be following. And I wonder what you think about that scenario. First of all, does that seem reasonable that would work out that way? And do you think that the administration would be prepared to, given everything that we have been through, still being involved in Afghanistan, still being involved in Iraq, would actually go ahead and attack Iran?
Strange. I'm not an expert at all on Iran, but I think there would be a certain negligence if our military was not at least trying to pinpoint where Iranian facilities were located. I think that's just prudent intelligence collection. My own view, for what it's worth, sir, is that the Iranian government, the theocracy, is in rather tough shape at the moment, and there seems to be a great deal of popular resentment toward the theocrats. I tend to think that Iran is a very nationalistic nation, however, and an American attack or an Israeli attack, which America condones, would more than likely rally support to the theocratic regime that now rules Iran, and it would rather strengthen the Islamic revolution and perhaps give it a stay of execution rather than finishing it off. I think an attack on Iran, either by us or by the Israelis or by both, would probably have the opposite effect than destroying that regime. The final point I would make is I don't really understand what the government is up to. The neoconservatives seem to be really just another brand of Wilsonianism with a more hands-on approach than Wilson had. And they certainly don't seem to understand foreign venues or foreign cultures very well. So I guess there is as good a possibility as not that they're planning some kind of a follow-on activity for their third conflict after Afghanistan and Iraq.
Let me introduce again our guest. We have some other callers. We're talking with Michael Scheuer. He served in the CIA for 22 years. His experiences in national security issues related to both Afghanistan and South Asia. He published a book initially anonymously while he was still in the CIA. It came out last year, titled Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, published by Brassey's. It is out there in bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. He resigned last fall from the agency, but continues to make some of the same kinds of criticisms. Here, and we're taking your questions. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana listeners, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll go to a caller in Charleston, and that is line 4. Hello.
Yes. It occurs to me that the overview of the events of the last 4 years should signify that the U.S. in particular, still acting out the old colonialist policies of Western Europe, should realize that people are not going to be benefited by what the neocons and others are calling democracy, when we should reflect upon the supposed democracy we have here, which is nothing but cliques and overwhelmed by capitalist powers, that freedom is non-existent, has no existence, that we're all subjugated to money and to the constant competition to get it, to hang on to it, to have some form of security, and to think that we are spreading that doctrine around the world. And if the election in Iraq, or the one supposing that your guest just articulated in Iran, what is the sum total of all of that? People are still not free. The people understand. That's why only 50% of people vote in the U.S., which is supposedly an old-time democracy, when it's all just a sham. And that's what is hurting the world. And we cannot help the powers that be here to invite into the mix what we call terrorism, which I'm struggling to understand all that to this day. And the comments early on after 9/11 that the one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Well, how are we going to come out of that haze? And what is freedom? And what is serenity and security and all those things while the world's superpower sits about and begins to agitate and to provoke all the things that your guest is talking about? I don't know if there's an answer to that, but I had to make those comments because we need to understand the world we live in and to be educated properly and get away from euphemisms and the constant pounding of TV in this country, and we're shipping that around the world even. So I'll ring off, and thank you, Dave.
All right. Well, I don't know. You may react to that any way you like.
One point I would make on that is that I'm not as bleak in terms of our own democracy and how our country works as the caller, but the one thing I would state is I think sometimes Americans could and should forgive our leaders for not fully understanding foreign cultures or languages or religious systems. But the one thing I think we can't forgive American leaders for is not knowing their own history. And the idea of democracy in America really is not a new idea. You can pick an arbitrary date, pick Runnymede in 1215, where the barons took some power from King John. Our democracy has been underway for 8 centuries now, and it's still far from perfection, and many of the problems the caller pointed out need to be addressed, surely. But the idea that somehow we can take 800 years of experience, which have been marked by, in this country, civil war and lynchings and delayed voting rights procedures, and around the world, Europe suffered through 100 years of religious war on their way to democracy. So I think there's a fundamental uneducatedness about American foreign policy in terms of how hard it is to establish a democracy. And the other point I would make is that there's such a cultural gap between what we see as positive and what at least much of the Muslim world sees as positive. For the most part, when we urge a Muslim country to adopt a secular democracy and say, look at how well it's worked for us, that's exactly correct. It has brought us prosperity and equity and a general lifestyle that is unprecedented in world history. But a secular democracy to so many Muslims, and they don't have to be fundamentalists or militants, secularism simply means turning your back on God. And not many Muslims of any variety are willing to do that. And so while I'm more optimistic than the caller about our own situation, I am not optimistic at all that the current set of leaders we've had in the last 2 decades really understand how hard the struggle has been for America to get to where it is and how unlikely it is that that can be put on a CD-ROM and given to the Iraqis and installed there in the next 6 months.
We're headed into our last 20 minutes now, and I have some other callers here, and I will get right back to you. But let me ask you this, because we've spent a lot of time talking about what has gone wrong to this point. Now, if I ask you the question, given everything that has happened, we've got to start from where we are now and go forward. What do you think the United States should be doing now? What should our priorities be now?
Mr. Inge, I think we're in a very difficult situation because By the basic failure to realize what our enemy is fighting us for, we have left ourselves with only two weapons so far, or two weapons at hand with which to fight Muslim insurgents or as Sunni militants, however you want to term them. And that's the U.S. military and the U.S. intelligence services. And those two organizations can hold the ring for a period of time. But what we really need to do, if we're going to approach this problem in a positive sense, in the sense that we are going to triumph and disarm our enemy, is we must look at those policies which bin Laden and so many other Muslims have identified as threats to their religion and threats to their society. Our unqualified support for Israel, our ability to keep oil prices low or at least acceptable to Western consumers, our support for countries such as China, Russia, India, who are perceived in the Muslim world as oppressing Muslims, and especially our support for Muslim tyrannies from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean. Unless we somehow look at those policies and say, are these still really in the interests of the United States, we will be left to fight only with our military and our intelligence services, which will mean a much greater death toll of our own people and of the people we're fighting. In many ways, this is a wonderful situation to be in for the United States because our destiny is in our own hands. Our enemy is focused on policies. Those policies allow our enemy to grow in terms of popularity, sympathy, donations, and actually people who will step up and take rifles to kill Americans. Our policies are bin Laden's only indispensable allies. And so if we take a look at those policies and try to amend them to a point where they can be looked at as positives in our arsenal of defense weapons, I think that's the way we need to go. And it's not an appeasement argument. It's not any kind of a surrenderist argument. It's simply the fact that no war is won by simply the military and the intelligence services. You must have a credible diplomatic policy, economic policy, public diplomacy policy. And right now we have only military and intelligence.
Let's talk with some other listeners. Next in line is Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I was wondering if you had an opinion as to how serious you thought the threat might be of Al-Qaeda acquiring a nuclear device of some kind.
I think, sir, that that's a very serious situation. The intelligence community, as the 9/11 Commission report showed, has known since late in 1996 that bin Laden had constructed an acquisition team that resembled that of a nation state. He approached it in the same careful manner. He used engineers and scientists and people who could tell whether he was being scammed or not by anyone who wanted to sell him a weapon of mass destruction. We also know that he has religious validation or religious justification to use a weapon against the United States. But most, I think, distressingly, and it's something that I think shows perhaps that I'm not broad enough in my readings, I was surprised during the election campaign to hear Mr. Bush and Mr. Kerry arguing about whether the Soviet nuclear arsenal should be fully under control by 2007 or 2010. I had been operating under the assumption that that was the first thing we did after the fall of the Berlin Wall, but apparently it's not. So given bin Laden's really superior organization in terms of trying to acquire one, his religious justification being adequate to use one, and the fact that one of the world's largest nuclear arsenals is still not under control, I think we need to assume that the chances that he will acquire some sort of a weapon are fairly good. And I must say that he's not interested at all in a weapon of mass destruction for its deterrent purposes. He wants to use it as a first strike weapon. He's not an apocalyptic man or a nihilist, someone who wouldn't have anything to do if he wasn't fighting. He clearly wants to end this war and defeat, in his terms, the United States. So the danger is the weapon's out there. He wants it. He will use it if he has it. And I consider it a very dangerous situation.
Yeah, I'd read that Nunn Lugar had a program where they thought maybe $50 or $80 billion would be necessary maybe to try to track down a lot of the highly enriched uranium and other materials. But I don't think that's really gone anywhere, and it would seem that that should be more of a priority.
It certainly seemed to me that that should have been a priority. Again, it's a shadow or a symbol of my ignorance, at least, and not being aware that we had not operated quickly and put those materials under supervision. Bin Laden, I think long since al-Qaeda has stopped looking to build a weapon of its own simply because it was too complicated and too time-consuming, and they have been looking for an off-the-shelf type of weapon, either one of these quote-unquote suitcase nuclear weapons or the nuclear artillery shells or other weapons that are all set to be used. So again, it's a situation which we need to worry, and I would think we need to accelerate the efforts we are making to assist the Soviets in securing their weaponry.
Just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, I want to thank the caller. We'll get some others in just a moment. I do want to reintroduce our guest, Michael Scheuer. He served in the CIA for 22 years, working in national security issues related to both Afghanistan and South Asia. He's the author of the book Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, published by Brassies. At the time it was published anonymously because he was still in the CIA. He has since resigned. Questions are welcome. We will continue to take callers and take as many as we can. The next in line is Wellington. That would be line number two. Hello.
Yes, I thought that was kind of interesting, the point you articulated about trying to, so to speak, bring us into economic ruin through terrorist activities, et cetera. And I never really gave too much thought to something like that until a couple years ago. I was taking a class, and one of the readings we had to do articulated that between supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and Star Wars and a few other promotions, that this was, in this writer's view, kind of the way Reagan brought the Soviet Union to its knees. And I do see some corollaries there, so I thought it was kind of interesting that you did articulate that point of view.
Well, thank you, ma'am. This is another point. I referred earlier to the kind of opposition there has been to publishing Bin Laden's writings and what he said. And in the summer of 2002 and 2003, in al-Qaeda's electronic journals on the Internet, there was a discussion amongst themselves on how they were going to defeat the United States. And they looked at the Vietnam War and decided that the North Vietnamese and the Soviets and the Chinese had decided that our center of gravity, our most vulnerable point, was public opinion, and had attacked that, and were successful. And within al-Qaeda's own journals, they've discussed this and said, no, that may have been true there then, but it's not true now. What the center of gravity for the Americans at the moment is their economy. And I think that is their intention. I think every dollar we spent in Iraq is really a dollar that Bin Laden views as another drop of our blood being shed. And so it's a very important, these people in many ways are very important to listen to. I don't think America has ever had an enemy who has been more precise about what he's going to do, why he's going to do it, and what he hopes to attain by doing it. In some ways, the canon of al-Qaeda's writings is not unlike Mein Kampf, and the regret the West has to have not paid more attention to that book when it was initially published in 1923. So I think we really do have to worry about our economy, and we have to see the deficit as at least a partial victory for Osama bin Laden.
Well, thank you for the call. Let's go on again to Champagne. This will be the next line number one. Hello.
Hello. I wonder if you'd give your opinion of a conversation I had with an Iranian academic over the weekend. He described the nuclear policy of the country as a no-lose policy. If they're successful, it adds to the prestige of the regime. But if we go in and destroy or attempt to destroy the installations, it will rally the Iranian people behind the regime as they've never had their support before. And I think I would add, it wouldn't be that easy to knock out the installations as it was against Saddam, because they've been a good deal smarter. They've scattered the installations around the country. Most are underground, and they're hardened, and there's a lot of duplication. Would you care to comment?
I would agree that Iran is a much more formidable adversary than Saddam ever would. Saddam was a tin pot dictator with an organization that was brutal, but not even really up to third world standards in terms of military. We discussed Iran a little bit earlier, and I do agree that it's very likely that the people who are opposing the theocracy, the theocratic regime at the moment, would rally to them. Iran is a very nationalist country and very proud of a two-millennium-old history. And I think an attack would certainly rally nationalism and the opponents of the regime to its support. The other point I would make is an attack on Iran might have the effect of doing something that has not been done in the past 1,000 years, and that's to bridge the sectarian gap between Shias and Sunnis. In the Sunni militant war against the United States, the Shias, for the most part, have stayed on the sidelines. I think an attack on Iran might well put both of those sects on the same side of the field opposed against us. So at the end of the day, we might not only have a stronger theocracy in Iraq, or in Iran, rather, I'm sorry, but a stronger Islamist militant movement around the world.
I think you're probably right. I think Iran would very much like to be the leaders of Islam, and they might well take it away from Obama.
Well, I think, sir, they have very much that aspiration, but there are so many times more Sunnis in the world, and in many ways the Sunnis are so much more powerful in terms of money and territory and just the overwhelming dominance of the Islamic religion, that it would be very hard for Iran to ever be as she is to be the leader of the movement. But certainly an attack by the United States would make them more acceptable as partners with the Sunnis.
Our next caller is in Chicago. Let's go there. Line 4. Hello. Yes.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Morning,
I've got
sir.
A question. Mine is that, you know, we have been pumped ever since 9/11 with the information of weapons of mass destruction, and now that President Bush has said that, you know, there really is none, or they can't find any. What did your guests feel the real reason for us going into Iraq was for?
Oh, I think they truly believe there were weapons of mass destruction there, sir. I think sometimes we forget that within the United Nations and within NATO, there was no real disagreement that Saddam was still working on WMD. I think there that it was mistaken, obviously, but I think that was a concern. Certainly the whole business about a connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq was a fabrication, to put it bluntly. There also might have been a desire to try to stabilize oil markets, because America has just not been willing to move away from fossil fuels toward alternate energy supplies. So I think there's a range of motivations, but the one thing that killed us, frankly, is that it doesn't appear that anyone ever considered the impact on the Islamic world of our war in Iraq, of our occupation now of the second holiest place in Islam. And that, to me, is the tragedy. The intelligence failure really lies in not realizing the impact, the negative impact this had on the war against terrorism, or the war against bin Ladenism.
As far as the intelligence goes, though, it's, you know, if you have a business and you find a place that makes widgets 20% cheaper than what you're buying them for, you know, and somebody tells you that, you know, you can get them over here, well, wouldn't you investigate this? I mean, wouldn't your, you know, it seems to me that the intelligence area, I mean, where these guys, you know, were saying that, you know, this is what's happening or whatever, was totally disregarded. by President Bush and his advisors. And according to Clark and different people that have been on the radio voicing the opinion that, you know, this guy was strictly looking for things for Iraq.
Well, that's certainly the word that's out in the media, I think. And frankly, it's unfortunate, but only George Tenet knows what he told the president and the Secretary of State. So I think until Mr. Tenet's book comes out, we're really not going to know. And one of the problems, though, goes back to not only the Bush administration, but to the Clinton administration, in that they both preach very, very strenuously that this has nothing to do with what we do in the world, but everything to do with the way we live, and that they hate our society. And so they don't regard this as a important they don't regard our policy as an important motivation to our enemy. And it's a tragic mistake for America, and you can see the way we're paying for it now really all over the world.
We're going to have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. We just want to say, Mr. Shoya, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate you being with us today.
Sure, it was my pleasure. You're very kind.